עוד שם תבקשי משאלה ואני אבקש חזרה ואם אתה שומע את קולי בחלום אני לא אוותר עליך והימים עוברים והלילות קשים הלב מדמה והנפש שלי כבר
Bienvenidos a la temporada 4, episodio 1 de Hoy Friendly, un episodio que va a ser íntegramente en inglés, les habla pasante del Mossad. Es un episodio que surgió de la iniciativa de mi amigo Apu, que encontró a una persona a la que está convencido que hay que darle voz, que todos tenemos que escuchar. Lamentablemente, como bueno, es un estadounidense y no habla castellano, hicimos el episodio en el idioma que hablábamos los tres. Esperamos poder después generar algún tipo de traducción de lo que hablamos. Pero me gustaría, Apu, si podés contar resumidamente quién es Umar Lee y de qué charlamos.
Umar es un norteamericano de Missouri. Nació en el seno de una familia cristiana y se convirtió en la adolescencia al Islam, a una versión que, según él cuenta, era bastante salafista, y vamos a ver qué significa esto con él. Y se crió en este mundo y en estas comunidades, compartiendo las visiones que tienen sobre Israel y sobre los judíos, que no son muy amistosas, pero empezó a generarle algunas dudas por su propia curiosidad y por lecturas amplias. Empezó a querer conocer un poco más, viaja a Israel y finalmente hoy se convierte en una de las lamentablemente pocas voces musulmanas en Estados Unidos que abogan por la paz con Israel y tiene una visión favorable hacia los judíos.
Y no solamente es una visión favorable hacia los judíos y hacia Israel, sino que también se anima a tener una visión crítica sobre el fundamentalismo y el terrorismo islamista, sobre el islamismo, que también nos ayuda a entender un poco qué es la diferencia entre el islam como religión y el islam como fuerza o proyecto político. Es un episodio que para mí, a veces me cuesta decir que es uno de los mejores episodios porque son todos uno más genial que el otro. Producir Hoy Friendly está siendo cada vez más satisfactorio a nivel espiritual y así como disfrutamos hacerlo, esperamos que la audiencia disfrute la inauguración de la temporada 4. No dilatamos más. Arranque.
Welcome everyone to Goy Friendly Season 4, Episode 1. It's been an incredible year, both for the good things and the bad things. And when we started to think about how we should start our first episode of this fourth season, Apu thought that it was the right moment to start a conversation which not everybody is ready to start. So a couple of months ago, he talked to me about someone called Umar Lee. And he said, we have to bring him on. We have to just have a conversation with him about the way he sees the world. He sent to me some videos about Umar Lee. And I said, we definitely have to have a conversation with him because I actually learned quite a few things. And some of the things that you said, Umar, now I'm going to introduce you in a minute, they opened my mind. I'm actually an open-minded guy. I left somehow my progressive lefty views from my younger days, but I would like to keep myself in the center, and that requires engaging conversations, hard conversations, and honest conversations. And I agree with Apu, you are a person that it's worth talking to and hearing all the things that you have to say about your background and your story and the ways you see the world. So I will deliver the mic to Apu just to give a brief presentation. Then I'm going to thank you, Shukran Gazilan, the way I've learned.
Shukran.
And Salam Alaikum. So Apu, please just whatever you can say about Umar Lee before we start discussing maybe or just engaging. I don't know.
Thank you, and welcome to everybody listening to this podcast. This is the first time that we record it without audience, so we'll see if we can keep it fresh. I will explain. Umar was not born in a Muslim family, right?
Yes, correct.
Yes. At a young age. He's from St. Louis, Missouri, or?
Yes,
around
St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. He has what I would consider a beautiful arc, narrative arc in his story. He's in his 40s, I think.
I have 1 year left.
What do you mean, 49?
I'm 49.
Okay.
I'm salivating this year.
So it's a beautiful moment to look back and tell us a little bit, briefly, about why you converted to Islam and what is Islam for you, and what branch of Islam you adhere to in your youth age. Let's start with that. And welcome, Umar.
Thank you. Like you said, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. I converted at the age of 17, so I was still a high school student. And there was actually a big influx of converts throughout the country in the late 80s and early 1990s. There were two things that really piqued the public's curiosity in Islam at this time. Number one was the release of the Malcolm X film by Spike Lee. A year leading up to that film, they did a major re-release of the autobiography of Malcolm X as told to Alex Haley. So a lot of people in my generation were reading this book and discovering Malcolm for the first time. And to bolster that, there were a lot of what you would refer to as the conscious hip-hop artists or the conscious rappers, mostly from New York City and the East Coast, who were sprinkling Islamic phraseology and concepts into their lyrics, just enough to pique the curiosity of people. And so this led a lot of people, including myself, to want to know more about Islam. And, you know, at that time, there were only two mosques in St. Louis. Now there are almost 30. In the metro area. And I had to open the phone book to try to find a mosque. Remember the old Yellow Pages? I had to open the Yellow Pages, and eventually you saw an advertisement in a newspaper for an introduction to Islam class. And it was very far from my home, but I began to take this class, and I got a couple of mentors from that class, and eventually led to my conversion. I think the popularity of Islam at that time, and of course it changes with the different eras, you know, like in the 60s and 70s, people were attracted to different things. It was definitely a place like St. Louis, which you got to realize is an area with very poor race relations, an area also that's very violent, very high crime, that was facing some serious economic issues. So it's an area where a lot of people were interested in kind of alternative solutions, alternative ideologies. And the promise of Malcolm, if you read the autobiography, definitely in the last chapters, is that Islam is a universal brotherhood. And that whereas America is divided upon racial lines, Muslims are united in faith. That's the idealistic concept and the one that, you know, attracted me. And like many converts of the 1990s, I, not immediately, but shortly thereafter, gravitated towards Salafis or the Salafi Dawah. That was what was very popular in the 1990s.
I will interrupt you just briefly, yes. So you can explain a little bit more. What is a Salafist like, or what do they think? Or how do they see the world?
Yeah, so the Salafi movement, which originates in Saudi Arabia, is primarily a movement to bring Islam back to the early generation. So Salafi comes from the Arabic Salaf al-Salih, it means the first three generations of Muslims. So you're trying to bring your practice and understanding of Islam back to the original three generations of Muslims. This is why some scholars, some academic scholars, not religious scholars, have referred to it as a kind of Islamic Protestantism, you know, or something of that nature. So And it was very popular because it was heavily funded from Saudi Arabia. It had state funding, and they were funding the publication of books, the importation of scholars. They were funding mosques. All these things dried up after 9/11. But at that time, in the 1990s, the Saudis were generously funding the spread of the Salaf movement in the United States. So it was very, very popular. It's less popular now.
It connects at some point with this idea of going back to the roots.
Yes.
Linked to the hip-hop movement, which we hear, go back to the roots.
Yeah. The irony is Salafis are adamantly opposed to music.
Yes, so I can't figure.
So people were turned on to Islam via music is one of the avenues, and then they stopped listening to music. And how you would know you were very good friends with somebody or they really trusted you is, you know, you would meet, you would hang out a few times, and if they really trusted you, you get in their car and they turn on the music. Like, okay, you gotta listen.
Well, that's becoming really intimate. You know, one of the prejudices that someone like me, which is an Argentinian, a Jewish Argentinian in Forest, when he gets exposed to the American culture and he sees that hip hop and rap, it's typically from the black people, and there you have to be very careful because there's a way to address of people according to the color of their skin. Yes. That's stuff that you learn once you go to the States. It's not like you can go and say whatever you see in the movies.
Yeah.
And there's also this connection with the black people and Islam, which strikes me right now because I don't know if the people that are going to listen to this episode and they hear you, they can figure out if you are an Afro-American or a white Anglo-Saxon, which is really amazing because we're going to, I don't know if we're going to leave that mystery, but I want to ask you, the moment you converted to Islam, what happened in your family?
Well, it's kind of interesting because my father had to leave town for work. So he was in the Philadelphia area in Delaware. And it was kind of estranged from my mother. So I was living with my grandparents along with my sisters. And they kind of had a different mentality. My grandmother was a church lady. She was very religious in the church, cook food, singing the gospel songs, the whole nine yards. She was very, very devout lady. My grandfather was never a religious guy. You know, he was a World War II veteran of the United States Marine Corps, and he just never took to the church. He would say, "I never met a preacher who didn't have his hand in your pocket." So he just said he wanted to go, and they wanted to take his money. So his mentality was, because I had so many friends at that age that were getting in trouble, going to jail, even getting shot, you know, things like that. His mentality was, well, if it's something that can keep him out of trouble, if it's something that can be positive, then he was supportive of that, you know. And my grandmother kind of, even though she was in church, she kind of had the same mentality. My dad was not happy, but he's not in town. You know, he was far away, you know, so he was kind of out of the picture. And my mother, you know, she had kind of lived this, you know, my mother was murdered in 2018. So she was alive in 92, but she had been living this kind of interesting life with a lot of characters moving in and out of it, a lot of dangerous characters and interesting characters. And she had known many who had converted to Islam in prison, because it's very popular to convert in prison. And her experience was, you know, they'll write you a letter in prison, you know, in broken English usually, you know, they're now Muslim, assalamu alaikum, and then they get out of prison, and after 2 or 3 weeks, they're back doing the same thing they did when they were. So that was her experience. So she didn't take it all that seriously because she had saw people convert before. But it's very important to mention this. You know, the white Muslim is few in the U.S., and I don't come from a typical background of white Muslims, but I'll get to that in a second. But there are usually, I would say, two doors for Islam in America. There is the quote-unquote immigrant door, and it's careful when you guys say immigrant because a lot of them are second generation, even third generation now, but quote-unquote immigrant experience, Arab, South Asian, et cetera. And so those that convert via that experience of those communities tend to have an outlook more in line with those communities. And then there is an African-American Islam, African-American Muslims, which is sociologically, economically, so a different part of the community. I mean, there's intermingling, there's mixture, there's a confluence, but it's sociologically and even oftentimes theologically different. But most white Muslims are entering through the quote-unquote immigrant door. They're marrying an Arab woman, or they've went to college. So you don't find that many kind of working class white converts. You mostly find people that were converted in college or post 9/11, you know, people that were Marxists, and they view Muslims as joining a revolutionary struggle, or progressives. You now have an intersection of oppression that you can, that you can identify with, or now the Palestinian issue. Now you can be a more effective Palestinian activist. And there's also fetishism. A lot of them, they may have a certain fetish for an Arab or other Islamic culture. So I didn't come from any of those things. It was a different, and there are some others like me. I have a few friends like that, but statistically we're non-existent.
So. I tend to say that I mentioned this in previous episodes, that to convert to Islam, you recite the Shahada, I think, three times?
Only once.
Okay, yeah. So you accept Allah as God, as your God, and Muhammad as your prophet.
Yes.
And then you become a Muslim, not simplifying it, but you adopt a lot of other ways of life, of course.
No pork.
No pork. Yeah. And it depends, no music in some cases.
Yeah.
No alcohol.
No alcohol, no fooling around if you're not married. You know, that's another one,
And with Christianity, it's something similar, where you say, I believe Jesus is my savior, something like that, and you are Christian. But, and this is what I tell in Goy Friendly, that in Judaism, you recite something from the Book of Ruth, which is, your people will be my people and your God will be my God. And it's not just that you have to do. You have to do a lot of other things. But the message is, you're part of a people now.
Yes.
And God, it comes with it, but it's not that mandatory. It's not the center. It's more the community. But for what you are telling us, the community is, a very important part of why people convert.
Absolutely.
It's a need. Yeah. I would say that people convert to religions due to the need not to be alone and the need to have answers to the questions that nobody has an answer for.
Yeah. We've realized Islam is like Protestant Christianity or evangelical Christianity. Evangelical, you can simply make a profession of faith, then you get baptized, you're Christian. The Catholic Church, you have to go through courses. They call it like the RIC courses or something like that. And it takes several months. With Judaism, conversion can take a year or two, depending on, if you're doing an Orthodox conversion or, even the Reformed have made their conversions a little more difficult in the U.S. So it's a process. But with the Muslim conversion, you literally have people converting on the street. I was in London in September, and they have a tent, a Dawah tent, outside of London Stadium. I was going to Man City versus West Ham game, and, they were trying to convert people outside of the stadium, Now, most of those people who would convert under such a circumstance will not stay Muslim very long. What I see is kind of the wisdom of the Jewish conversion is, okay, when somebody actually does convert, they actually know what they're doing. They've been through study. They've been through coursework. They have to go to a religious court, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
No, you mentioned Dawah. I think that it's like missionary, right?
Like missionary.
Shlichut. In Judaism, we don't. I'm looking at Passante now.
It's cool.
But they don't look to convert people that are not Jews.
Yeah.
They just want Jews to be more.
Only a Javier Milei. It's the only only non-Jew they're going to convert. So, yeah.
And yes. Talking about that, sorry, you mentioned that you were in your young first years into Islam. You were part of a Salafi, or that was kind of the ideology. What was the view of Jews in that ideology?
Well, the view of Jews doesn't change much, unfortunately, whether you're a Salafi, a Sufi, a Tablighi, you know, whatever segment of the community you're filling with. And it's a very negative view. I mean, this is the reality, is that, and I've had many conversations with Muslims about that, there's very few issues that Muslims agree on. You know, Muslims are constantly fighting and bickering and arguing and excommunicating each other, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes to Jews, or when it comes to Israel, there is unanimous animosity. There is a nearly unanimous hatred. And the most controversial thing you can do in the Muslim community is be sympathetic to Israel, be pro-Israel, or speak about anti-Semitism within the Muslim community. People you think are moderate, people you think are sensible, and people you know to be intelligent, people you know to be generally nice people in their day-to-day lives, the minute Jews come up, the minute Israel comes up, there's just a complete loss of the mind, a complete detachment from reality. And I'd like to separate here Jewish and Israel. So we can just talk about Jewish in terms of discussion via Jews in the United States, or the talk is generally very conspiratorial, similar to what you would hear from a traditional anti-Semite in the U.S., just with a little Islamic flair added in. And then you add the Israel piece of the puzzle, and it's a very negative climate. So I would say Salafis, yes, were problematic towards Jews, but I actually think maybe not as bad as some others, like the Ikhwanis, the Muslim Brotherhood influence, people who were very politicized. And 'cause the Salafis in America, largely, most are apolitical. Most Salafis in the U.S. are apolitical, unlike the UK.
I would like to rely on that statement, just to let you explain the difference between Islam and Islamist would be like in yeah. Spanish, like the political ideology behind Islam, because you tied it to Marxism, and that triggered my notes about your video explaining the connection between the revolutionary Islam and all that stuff. What's the role of the Jew there, and why the Salafis are not maybe that mean to Jews as other branches?
Well, I think they can be even worse. They just haven't had necessarily the opportunities. And also in the U.S., Salafis tend to be apolitical. The U.K., Salafis are political, or more so, because they follow a different strand of Salafis. So they may be the worst in the U.K., but in the U.S., because they're detached from protests and detached from politics and detached from boycotts, not as much. The revolutionary Islam comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Ikhwan Muslimin, and also from the Sahwa, the reawakening revival of the 1970s, and then kind of merges at some point between Sunni and Shia with what happened in Iran with the Islamic Revolution of Iran. You see within revolutionary Islamic understanding, within Islamist understanding, when you say Islamist, a lot of people misuse the term. An Islamist is someone who believes in Islamic revivalist politics, creation of Islamic states. That there's different visions of what Islamic state is. Is this an individual state? Is this a coalition of states? Is this a unitary state? But generally, this is what an Islamist is. So what has happened, particularly post 9/11 in the U.S., but even going back to the 1970s in places like Egypt and Iran, a strong mixture with the political left, and using the terms and ideological concepts of the left and just Islamifying them. And this is where the binary occupied occupier comes from. Colonized, colonizer. In Islamic law, these concepts don't exist. you have to go to the left to get these concepts. So it is this mixture. So in America, what we saw is post 9/11, the Muslim community, which was a very conservative theological community, really kind of detached from politics, makes an alliance with the left to oppose the war in Iraq, to oppose the Patriot Act and some of the measures of the Bush administration. And the younger generation go very far to the left. The irony is, in the last few years, there's been a correction. So there's been the growth of a right-wing Muslim segment in the U.S., but not a very positive segment of the right. It's kind of like a fanatical right-wing segment. But they both, when it comes to Israel, there's no difference in the two. They see eye to eye. Yeah.
So you mentioned that in Islam, the terms or the concepts of colonizer and colonized do not exist. Could it be because Islam has expanded through colonization?
That's right.
How do Muslims that adhere to this leftist concept of the victim and oppressor and a binary point of view of victims and oppressors, how do they explain the history of Islam?
So from the American perspective, Muslims in America are the same as Christians, Jews, and others, is that we have this hubris that nothing existed before us and nothing exists without us. And so the whole world is looked at through the prism of American politics, American race, etc., right? So if you're in the U.S., you don't even have to address why are people in Morocco speaking Arabic? Why are people in Mauritania speaking Arabic? Why do people in Bangladesh have Arabic names? You don't have to address any of these little complicated parts of history because you're just dealing with the present. And you're filtering, for example, Israel, filtering it through American race. So through this concept, Israelis are white and Palestinians are people of color. Now, we know this has no basis in fact. If you go to Israel, you know, you can't really, you know, the Mizrahi and the Arab, and there's white, blonde hair, blue-eyed Arabs, and there's black Jews, etc.
Falajas and
Yemenis and Morocco, you know. So to put our concept of race in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is completely foolish, but it's what people do. And then under that binary, it's like religion. You have an oppressor, and you have an oppressed. And agency is removed from the oppressed. So the oppressed are free to work against the oppressor by any means at their disposal. And that's where you get the justification for the atrocities of October 7th. Not just from Muslims, but from the left in general in the United States.
Omar, there are so many roads that are now opening, and we're going to have, like, choose where we go from here. Not because I feel uncomfortable. Actually, it's because I really like to talk about everything with you. And I think before we start on any of the different roads, maybe we can go back and then try another one. I would like to put something else on our backpack. I hear you, and I can feel that somehow I can relate to your story because I was kind of like mingling in my young age with the left. I was angry because I was a Jew and I was part of something that was kind of like a warmonger or something like that. And then I realized I just can't quit being a Jew. I can be a secular Jew. I can somehow understand that I'm going to be connected to Israel as long as I live. So the best thing I can do is just enjoy it, stand for it, explain it. But your story is different because you have chosen Islam as the way to go through life, through the questions of life, like Apu said. How did you relate with this part of looking at the Jews from Islam in that overall mindset that you just described? Did you feel like, okay, I have to be pissed off about Jews and I have to hate Israel because it comes with a package?
Yeah, when I was young, that was very much the understanding. You know, this is how I was educated. This is how I was taught, not just vis-a-vis Israel, vis-a-vis Jews, you know, theological teachings that were hostile to Jews and seeing Jews as a You know, the typical rhetoric, the Jews killed the prophets, the Jews were cursed, you know. I used to have a teacher that when he would say the Jew, he would always back up every time, the Jew. And he would back up and say the accursed Jew. You know, that would be his next line. And I remember I had a teacher said that, what do you have a line? He said the Jew is like a dog with a tail. And you try to put a cast on the tail to make the tail straight, but you take the cast off and it's still crooked. You know, so you, and I was also subject to conspiracy. You know, the Muslim community has, and unfortunately, it's become mainstream. Muslims were the canary in the coal mine. Now it's mainstream. All these conspiracies that Pepsi stood for, pay every penny to save Israel, and McDonald's every Monday and Thursday give all their profits to Israel. And I remember the one in the nine Arab presidents are secretly Jewish. And I remember they said King Fahd wasn't Jewish, but when he was a baby, he suckled from the breast of a Jewish woman and had become infected and under the control of Jews because of that. So and Yasser Arafat was secretly Jewish, and the king of Morocco was Jewish.
They won out. I mean,
you could almost have a minion, you know, with the
It's interesting because it's stuff that I never heard about. So I would like to do some research about this, because it's like, first of all, I want my share of anything that we have power ties to, because I'm a Jew. I'm entitled to this.
I mean, you know, like Hollywood stars who aren't Jewish. I mean, there's enough Jews in Hollywood. There's a lot of Jews in Hollywood, but the people say, Julia Roberts is a Jew. You know?
So you were exposed to that, and spoiler alert for those listening to us, you traveled a couple of years ago to Israel. What happened in the middle?
Well, no, my first time to Israel was 1996. I went with a Palestinian family who, they had a place in Mochayim Shofat, which is a refugee camp in East Jerusalem, and Anata, which is a neighborhood just outside of Jerusalem. That was my first experience, and I didn't do anything that time other than we went to En Gedi, which is a nature reserve, but mostly I went around the Palestinian community. I went back in 1999 because my interest had kind of been piqued. So I had began to read, and I said, I want to go back and to see more and see the Jewish side as well, see the Israeli side as well. So I went back and I spent a lot of time there. And I spent a lot of time in Jerusalem especially, but I traveled around a bit, but mostly in Jerusalem. And I talked to Israelis, I talked to soldiers, I hung out with yeshiva students. So I would go to Al-Aqsa Mosque on Friday in the day, and at night I would go to the Kotel. And there used to be a rabbi, an American rabbi, Rabbi Jeffrey Seidel. He used to be there, and he would ask if you had a place for Shabbat. So I'd end up usually at this Rabbi Mackles from New York at his house, but you know, we'd end up at Shabbat dinner tables. You know, I remember one night we were at Shabbat meal and they had some sweets and wine. And they said, we're going to walk around the old city and we're going to hand deliver these to the soldiers that, you know, that are out on their Shabbat. And I remember thinking to myself, man, this is crazy, man. I mean, if any of my Muslim, you know, because I had met, you know, some Palestinians on my previous trip, I said, if I run in, they're going to say, what the hell is going on with this, you know? And so I had a great experience. And, you know, I met people who were wonderful. And I met people that were kind of crazy, too. I mean, I went out to, you know, I went out I went out to Hebron, for example. You know, I hung out with some Palestinians there, and then I walked into the settlement, started hanging out with settlers. And those guys were super friendly when they started talking about politics. Man, these guys are really nuts, man. Just, you know,
You're familiar with the Yiddish word of Mishigene, which is crazy, like seriously crazy. But where did that all came from, the idea to just check maybe the other side is not like I thought it was? Because of the danger.
I just always like to learn more and read more and study and not necessarily accept the story given to me. And I began reading, you know, so I'm reading some Jewish history books and reading some...
Paul Johnson's?
No, I read like Chaim Potok and, you know, his books, The Wanderings. And that was a really influential book on me. And he was a great novelist as well. Wrote a lot of fiction about Jewish life in New York City. And, you know, all the things that kind of piqued my curiosity. So I later read the biography of Chaim Weizmann, who was one of the, you know, founders of Israel. And I even got a Spanish translation of it because I had a Colombian friend. You know, he speaks English, but he didn't read it well enough to understand it. And I gave it to him. So it's in Spanish. So if somebody in Argentina wants to read it. And, you know, then 9/11 happens. And I think all of us begin to have this kind of reassessment. You know, I was in the Miami suburbs when 9/11 happened. I was around a lot of people from Brazil and Argentina and Cuba. And I mean, I love South Florida. I love Miami. And I think I began to have a reassessment like a lot of other people did. Like, wow, you know. And at the same time, a lot of my friends were going to jail because the 1990s was a reckless time and people had done reckless things. Some of them overzealous prosecutions. You know, the government didn't know quite what was going on, so they were in a hurry to put people away. So I think some of those prosecutions were not well thought out and they wouldn't happen today. And so this climate led me to even further reassessment and finding my place. So I tell people, you know, I have a reputation as a political activist in St. Louis. I've done a lot of political work. Some has been very successful. There's nothing I could do that would be more popular in St. Louis right now than run out and burn an Israeli flag and fly a Palestinian flag and organize that type of campaign. In fact, after October 7th, a prominent Muslim activist in St. Louis reaches out to me and says, hey, I need some help with media relations and some of your expertise. And I said, man, you know, I'm really the wrong person to be asking this question to because, you know, I'm not in the pro-Palestinian camp. I'm not, this is not where I'm at, you know. So that is a very popular position. It's a popular position within St. Louis Democratic politics. And St. Louis is a one-party town, right? And it's extremely popular within the Muslim community. What's unpopular is what I'm trying to do is nuance, understanding, speaking of the right for Israel to exist, to thrive, to live in peace.
Do you find some sort of echo or good reception despite the general perception of Israel or the Zionist movement as the enemy, the type of people you just described?
I mean, the general sentiment with Muslims is that Israel should not exist and that the American Jewish community, other than the quote-unquote anti-Zionist Jews, who are very few, have a negative role in the U.S. and the world. That is a view that's increasingly shared, not just on the right, on the left, but some on the right, particularly younger people. So that went from kind of a fringe view that you would hear amongst Muslims and the hard left to a view you're starting to hear from a lot of people. And I think one of the culprits is TikTok and social media, that a lot of people are getting their information. And when I try to talk to people, they get emotional. And the first thing they will say is, how much are the Jews paying you?
It's amazing. You know, something like that happened to Yosef Haddad.
Yeah, everybody that is not Jew that speaks up, sometimes not even for Israel, but for
the West. Let's
not slaughter civilians and kids, it's just things. It's called collaborationist and accused of getting money from Israel.
I asked them if I'm paid by the Jews, they must have mailed the check to the wrong house or put the money in the wrong account. And where do I go? Do I show up at the kosher deli and ask for my check? Do I get a free hot pastrami sandwich, or what's going on here?
Yeah, or my sandwich won't work because you drink alcohol. So, but I remember the last video I saw of you in your car, I think, just sharing some reflections on how the United States, it's not going to be the ally it is today for Israel because of these young people coming of age, being raised by TikTok, learning whatever they learn in college.
And other factors, because support for Israel in the U.S. generally has come from three segments. The evangelical Christian, number two, the memory of the Second World War and the Holocaust, and number three, the American Jewish community, which is largely non-Orthodox. And all three are in serious decline. The people that remember the Second World War are dying. We're getting older. America is growing less religious, and the younger generation is less religious. So there's fewer people that are religious with a affinity for Israel. And the third thing, you can read Alan Dershowitz's book, I think it's called The Disappearing Jew or The Vanishing Jew or something like that, is that the American Jewish community is getting smaller and more Orthodox because the intermarriage rate and the assimilation rate is so high for non-Orthodox Jews in the U.S. And if you look at any of what they say, quote-unquote, the Jewish lobby, and not just that, your Jewish community centers, your organizations that hold up Jewish life in the U.S., these are mostly non-Orthodox Jews. But when the baby boomers die out, a lot of these institutions are gonna close. There's not going to be enough people to keep them open. And you're already seeing it in, you know, organizations have to merge and downsize, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So my argument, if I sat down with Bibi, if I had lunch with Bibi in Jerusalem, I would tell him, first of all, why is Yair in Miami and not in uniform? That would be the first thing I would ask him. But the second thing is, I'd say, hey, this American ally may have a 10-year, 15, 20-year life. I think it'd be in the best interest of Israel to strike a good deal, a favorable deal, while you have this strong ally, as opposed to 20 years with a deal being imposed on you with virtually no international allies. So there's no good situation, but this may be the best bad option.
Talking about deals, I think that Israel has tried, let's focus in Gaza. Israel has tried many different things, even withdrawing. Unfortunately, it does not just depend on Israel and the U.S. So what do you think could be, and not asking you as a international geopolitical analyst, but from your sincere point of view, what could be the future of Gaza after the war? I mean, what could be in a way that helps the coexistence of the two peoples?
That's the million-dollar question, because there really are no good options. Israel does, I mean, the Netanyahu government doesn't want to give it to the PA, Palestinian Authority, and they also don't want to occupy it. So what are the options? I really think there's no solution for Gaza outside of a regional deal and understanding with Saudi Arabia, with the UAE, with Egypt, everyone at the table together for a security arrangement. Because what you would need in Gaza is you need a security entity to make sure Hamas does not reemerge, other groups don't reemerge, and you're going to probably have to create a buffer zone between Gaza and the Green Line. You're probably going to create a Green Line like you had in Lebanon.
I think that will never be enough unless you change the education system.
Oh, 100%. Band-Aid.
So with Pasante, our proposal to the UN is to give the security to Saudi Arabia and the education to the UAE.
I would love it, but I think it would be a great idea. I don't know if it was happening. Now, the Saudis, see what the Saudis would do is just like they do in Yemen. is when they were fighting, they subcontract. So technically, Saudi was at war with Yemen, and they were, but it was Saudi pilots and Air Force, but most of the ground troops were Egyptians and Sudanese, and so that's what they would do. The Saudis would be in charge of the orchestration, but they would subcontract with the various people that they're loaning billions of dollars to say, okay, here's another $3 billion. I need 20,000 young men in Gaza, that type of idea. But yeah, I mean, long term, you got to change the educational system. You got to change the culture. There's just a really disturbed thing with the culture of martyrdom and the euphoria over death and the yearning for your children to be martyrs. And it's just a really disturbed thing. And the thing is, there's a lot of conflicts throughout the world, far bloodier than a Palestinian conflict, far more deadly. And you don't see like this pathological cult of martyrdom. It seems to be only when Jews are in question that you get this euphoria over death, this celebration of death. I mean, if you've seen people in Times Square celebrating the death of people in the Syrian civil war, have you seen or anywhere else in the world, the ongoing civil war in Burma? Have you ever seen anyone euphoric over the death of people in that conflict? There seems to be a different set of rules when Jews in question, which is a place I want to visit. I read the excellent book, The Murder of Moises Via, and it was an excellent book. I think what they called Argentina, the New Jerusalem or something like that. And I watched a documentary on the horrific bombing of the Jewish Community Center in the 1990s by Iranian proxies. Hezbollah. Yeah. And so a lot of people in the U.S. may not realize that Argentina has especially in Buenos Aires, right, has a large Jewish community.
Yeah.
And there are pockets in all throughout Latin America. But the Jewish community in Latin America is so small that, outside of Argentina, I think, if you meet a Jewish person from Peru, as an example, I know one Peruvian Jewish family here in St. Louis, and I've met Peruvian Jews, and they all know each other. Oh, yeah.
And that's a game we like to play, which is, do you know that person? Which is
Jewish geography.
Two degrees of separation.
I would like to mention Umar Lee's Twitter account. Why don't you say it? And
it's Umar Lee with a U, UmarLeeIII. So like Umar Lee 3, Roman numerals, UmarLeeIII at Twitter. I also have TikTok and Instagram, which are under STL Stranger, meaning the St. Louis Stranger. STL Stranger. So you can follow me either places. I also have a Substack newsletter you can subscribe to.
We mentioned Bibi Netanyahu. It's clear we like it. It's somehow in this conversation. And then there's come this problem about being able to criticize the government, which is currently in power in Israel, criticizing Israel as a state and denying the right to exist and the right to self-defense. I would really like to thank you, now that I have another opportunity to thank you for just not coming here, but to standing out. But I would like to know, how do you feel when we just speak out loud about this and then you just receive probably insults or threats? I mean, what happens when you say, okay, I can criticize Netanyahu, but I won't stand against Israel or the right to self-defense?
I try not to pay attention to it because very little of it is constructive and worthy of engagement with. And there's nothing informative I can hear. So I know that there are people, here in my city that have campaigned against me, that are very angry with me. But I don't let it get to me because I have no doubt. And if you look through history, all the anti-Semites in history all the anti-Semitic entities in history normally meet a very poor fate. So history is the great teacher that one of the measurements of a healthy individual in a healthy society is their attitude towards Jews or the presence of anti-Semitism. If you show me an unhealthy society, usually you'll find anti-Semitism prevalent in that society. And people are going to advocate for October 7th and advocate that the massacre of families is justified and the capturing and kidnapping and murdering people at parties and raping women is acceptable. If they're going to stand upon that, and if people are going to applaud that, and that's a popular position, then I have no problem being unpopular. None at all. And I try not to even interact with those type of critics because there's no benefit in engaging with people who are not constructive and not in basic touch with their humanity. But it does feel like, personally, myself, that I'm in a very, very unpopular position. Whether it's my St. Louis community or whether it's the Muslim community, it's that, you know, take away the Jewish community, it feels very isolated. And I have a very good friend of mine here, this Israeli Jewish guy here in St. Louis, Ben Perumba. He owns a Jewish deli here. So if you're ever in St. Louis, you can come to his deli. He owns an Israeli restaurant too. So.
I'll just keep it in mind.
Yeah.
I'm so, all about about eating. I like it.
Come to St. Louis. So it's a, you know, don't stay long, and you may not be able to stay long. you know, he was an old lefty. He was an old lefty, and he's like a lot of middle-aged Jewish leftists, is that he somewhat of identity crisis, somewhat of feels like there's been a betrayal of all the people he's worked for over the years, all the people he's been in alliance with, he's advocated for them, and now they are uncritically supporting the Hamas positions. So he feels let down and betrayed. And I think a lot of Muslims, such as myself, feel betrayed because we've been trying to advocate for more moderate positions and reassessments and contextualizations. And all that's just flown out of the window since October 7th, where there's been more or less a tribal bloodlust. It's like a digital pogrom, more or less, is what's happened.
Speaking about the left and those comments you had made, or we have talked about identity politics, I remember 1 year ago, Argentina won the World Cup.
That's right. Congratulations.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah.
Back then, there was a publication on, I think it was the Washington Post, that some U.S. scholar asked why there are no black players in the Argentinian team.
Yeah.
And it became a big issue in Argentina because they were basically calling us racist by applying categories of the U.S. race situation to the rest of the world that are completely incorrect. And
he didn't have any women players on the team too, so it was very
right. So what do you think of the woke, I don't know if to call it an ideology, but both in the U.S. and applied to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, it has everything to do with it because an American politics now, there's an obsession with identity, not just with the left. It's on the left and right. On the left, there's an obsession with intersectionality and using the lenses of like DEI or CRT. And I talked to Yossi Klein Halevi, the author, last year, and I said, hey, doesn't this seem inherently anti-Semitic? He said, I think you might be right. Because if you
can you explain what is DEI? Maybe not all our listeners know about it, and it's really important, I think.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's a comprehensive set of teachings that are being filtered into the educational system and in corporate America, where jobs, office places, schools are having DEI officers. It's almost similar to you know, if you study history of communist states, they would have an official of the party in a factory or in a warehouse. And before a shift, you know, people are getting ready to make engines for boats. Someone would come and give them a lesson on Marx for the day, or posters throughout the building. So DEI has intensified this obsession with identity. And so if you go to a lot of people's Twitter handles, you'll see they have four or five identities. You know, left-handed, neurodivergent, Argentinian American, indigenous, Latinx, left. You know, there's this numerous identities.
It's more about tax. The more you collect,
the better. If you have fewer, you're in trouble. You know, so there's this obsession with identity on the left, and on the right, through the MAGA movement, it's created a reaction of identitarian populists against the identitarians on the left. So instead of contesting ideas, contesting civic virtue, you know, things that are generally beneficial for all the public, no matter your identity, it's all a tribal competition. And unfortunately, the Jewish identity is not a popular identity on the left. It's not one. So if you're a young Jewish activist, you have to say anti-Zionist Jew. Anti-Zionist Jew.
It's like a video game. It's like a video game with cards or something. Like you have a deck of heroes which are identities, and then you just put them on.
If you really want to be an edgy anti-Zionist Jew, you got to start posting a lot of Yiddish.
Okay.
Just showing you're against the Hebrew, the language of the colonizers.
Okay. And what do you think about the DEI and this woke revolution?
Well, I'm in a bad situation because I'm a heterosexual white male. So I'm unredeemable. I have no hope. I have no hope. And no, look, whenever identity, I mean, the exploration of identity is an interesting topic, but whenever that's the focus of your political identity and your religious identity and your social identity, I think there's an absence of ideas, and it could be an absence of virtue, because the ideas of humanity should bond us, not divide us, should bring us together, not divide us. And in a multicultural society like the United States, if there's just this nonstop focus on identity, it's not healthy for society, because we all have to benefit together, you know, and we all suffer together. You know, when an earthquake comes, it's not or a hurricane or a tornado, it's not going to just afflict someone of a certain identity. We're all living here together, and we all have to advocate for things that are going to be beneficial to us all.
I would like to thank you again for your time, and maybe ask the last question to close. If the young Umar, I don't know, that probably that was not your original name, but if the young you would have encountered Jews instead of Muslims in your early teenage years, would you perhaps would have thought about converting to Judaism instead?
I think so. I think I would have, but under the right circumstances. Not in St. Louis, but if I was in New York City or if I was in Israel. Because I socially vibe with New York Jews and Israeli Jews. I don't know about the Latin American. I'll see you in Colombia and Peru. I mean, in Panama. But I think so, because I find the religion very interesting and very attractive. But it wasn't something even on the radar. Because St. Louis, we have actually a fairly large Jewish community, but they're mostly in the western part of the metro, which was far from me. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a older cloister community. Like, you know, not a lot of mixing in the city and stuff. You know, so it wasn't until I got to Israel and I lived in New York City for years that I saw like a really vibrant community that not only did I found it, you know, very attractive. So who knows? This is the game of history. Who knows?
Yeah.
I think we have a I would say hell of a conversation, but I don't know if hell is like the right word. But I really prefer Jew, so I can say that kind of thing. Out of the couple, Apu is the more civilized. I am like the heathen, but from a heathen Jew, Shukran Gazilan again, Umar. I will say again what I taught Apu that I learned from my Arabic teacher, Tasha Rafna, which is, it's been an honor. It's really been an honor. I really hope you can get as much people listening to your message and whatever you have to share with the world from your experience being a Muslim, an open-minded Muslim, someone that understands the miracle of being alive and the need to keep on asking the same questions that everybody does, which is, why are we here? What can we do to make things better? And having a conversation is really, really, really powerful. I really hope this goes beyond our borders. There's going to be like a lot of people listening to us, and they're going to say, okay, I can't believe you just guys did this and this time with everything that's happening. That's the reason why we're here. And then again, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. Todal Rabba, Baruch Hashem, Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov for you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, all right, good night.
Thank you very much.
עד שתחזור לא